Blog Talk Radio.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat! Burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor from an old fruit jar. Well, do anything that you want to do, but honey, lay off of my shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but take me off of my blue suede shoes. Rock it! All the money, looking for the show, three to get ready. Now go, 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 but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me off of my blue suede shoes. Well, it's blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Yeah! Blue, blue, blue suede shoes, baby. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but take off of my blue suede shoes.
Hello and welcome to the Judy Joy Jones Show. I hope you love Elvis Presley as much as I do. Blue suede shoes. Today we are honored to have Gary Patterson. And Gary is a frequent guest on Coast to Coast, the very, very famous radio show with George Norrie. And he is actually their rock and roll expert. He has three best-selling books on Amazon.com about rock and roll artists, and all I can say is this man will answer any questions probably that you could ever think of having to do with rock and roll artists throughout history. I'm really excited. I heard him on a show, and I just thought, wow, he knows his stuff. And if you notice on the description page of our show, you're going to see three of his books that you can buy. They are available at Amazon.com. He is the author of The Walrus Was Paul and Hellhounds on Their Trail. And let me go ahead and bring Gary up, because I always like to have the guests tell everyone about themselves much better than having me try to read it from a script, I think. I believe this is Gary. Hello?
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you, Gary?
I'm doing fine, thank you for asking.
Great, did you enjoy the song?
Oh, I've heard it a few times. It's a great song, yes. Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins wrote it, so it's a great song.
Did you know, did you know him? Where are you? You're Tennessee, right, Gary?
Yes, I am. I'm in East Tennessee. I met Carl Perkins in, I think it was 1996. And I was signing books in Nashville, and this tall man in a black outfit came up to me, and he says, "Gary, would you sign your book for me?" And I looked up, it was Carl Perkins.
I was honored
to sign The Walrus Was Paul for him. And then I knew he was going to be there, so I looked under the desk, and I found a copy of his book, Go Cat Go. So I said, "Carl, I'll sign mine for you, but you sign yours for me." And he wrote in my book, he says, "To Gary from your friend Carl Perkins." And then he wrote, "Go Cat Go." So it was really cool. It was really a great experience to meet him, and he had some great stories. And it was always fun to listen to great stories.
You are amazing. The people you have met in your lifetime, I heard you actually on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. I know you've been on with, is it Ian Punnett?
I've been on Ian and both.
did you, well, what I thought was so fascinating was that you truly are an expert on many, many, many people. That, and I want to say one thing before we get started. We have a caller, and I don't know, were you expecting, it's a little early, but if you don't mind, let me see who they are.
Oh, sure. I have no idea, but yeah.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, who is this?
Hi, it's Shemaine. How are you?
Hey, Shemaine. You know, Gary, this is Shemaine Kenton, and she is going to co-host with me. That's kind of what I want to check out because we didn't have a time to really get this going. And Shemaine is a great, great artist herself and author, and she's a wonderful person. So, Shemaine, this is Gary.
Hi, Gary. A pleasure to meet you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. I like anybody who knows all about rock and roll. I have to admit, when I was a kid, my father and my twin uncles had all the little 45s, so I started finding out about rock and roll, listening to the original Coasters and things from Motown. I mean, my friends and I found a whole new world of music. We were like maybe about 10 or so of things that came out of the 50s and the beginning of rock and roll. So I'm totally fascinated to know what you're, you know, with your subject completely.
Well,
thank you.
You know, are there many myths and curses in rock and roll?
Oh, there's a great many myths that are basically, a lot of them can easily be explained. But I know that when I did Coast to Coast with George, and we talk about something that reoccurs over and over again, you know, I know George always says there's no such thing as coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some pretty strange stories. And, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know if you would definitely call it a curse. My definition of a curse is something that, a series of bad luck that lasts for years. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you've seen the movie Spinal Tap, they have a problem with exploding drummers. So certain bands have hot seats for artists, you know, that
mm-hmm.
like if you're going to play in the Grateful Dead, don't be a keyboard player, you know, because all of them have passed away.
Whoa.
I didn't realize that.
No, that's not good.
It's not good. So as long as you don't, any other instrument, the Grateful Dead will be fine. But I guess if I had to take what I would call the greatest curse of all, would probably be the Buddy Holly curse. And everybody knows about the day the music died on February 3rd, 1959, when Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper finished playing in Clear Lake, Iowa, and they rented a small plane. And the plane crashed, and all three of the rock stars were killed, which was a terrible tragedy. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, 1959 was really not the day the music died. It was almost a year that rock and roll died. And if you think about it, in 1959, Elvis was still in the Army. Little Richard became a minister and gave up rock and roll for a while. Chuck Berry was arrested and put in jail for violation of the Mann Act. And Jerry Lee Lewis had married his 13-year-old cousin.
Yeah.
His career had ended in rock and roll for a while, and then Alan Freed, the very father of rock and roll, who gave it its name, was tormented by the payola scandals, and it was all over. So in 1959, you had the advent of the, I guess you would say, not boy bands, but you had Fabian, and you had Tommy Sands and Frankie Avalon, and it became like a young man's Dean Martin. And it really wasn't the energy of rock until 1964 when the Beatles landed and took it back in the British invasion. So, you know, 1959 was a terrible year for rock and roll.
Isn't
but
that crazy? And the 50th anniversary, this is the 50th anniversary, right? Of the
it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard it, but it was on January 30th on Coast to Coast. I put together a show that had the original Peggy Sue. That Buddy Holly had written a song for. And I had Donna Ludwig Fox, who Ritchie Valens had written a song Donna for. And then I had the Big Bopper Jr. And I had Tommy Allsup, the guy who flipped the coin with Ritchie Valens, but he was traveling. We couldn't get a good phone connection. So we had probably one of the greatest stories behind the day the music died and some of the eerie things that happened with it. So it was great for me to bring Peggy Sue and Donna on the air with me. We had a great time.
That was amazing. You know about them, don't you, Shemaine?
Oh, yeah, I know about them. I mean, these are things that, you know, these are the stories that you've listened to for years.
Mm-hmm.
And about that whole, about what happened to them and
mm-hmm.
when that plane went down. And I believe now, maybe you can tell this story about that plane there that night. Somebody was supposed to get on the plane, and there was some story about flipping of the coin. Who was that?
Well, actually, there's two great stories with that, because the real reason Buddy Holly leased the plane was because they were on a school bus that kept breaking down. It was 30 degrees below zero,
ooh,
and they were burning newspapers in the bus to keep warm. And then they didn't have their laundry. It was never clean, and they had to sleep sitting up on the bus with dirty clothes. And Buddy Holly decided that he wanted to rent a plane so he could get to the next town ahead of time, have his clothes laundered, and rest. Now, when the plane was purchased or the lease was given, it was for Buddy Holly, it was for Waylon Jennings, and it was for Tommy Alsop, two backup musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the big bopper had the flu, and he was sick, and he goes up to Waylon Jennings, and he says, "Listen, Waylon, let me have your seat on the plane because I could get a chance to see a doctor, maybe get a shot and make me feel better. If you let me take your seat, you can have my sleeping bag that my wife purchased for me right before I left." Well, Waylon Jennings enjoyed being on the bus, even if it was 30 degrees. He enjoyed the camaraderie. So the big bopper took Waylon's seat. Now, the last seat was what's interesting, because Richie Valens was actually the main star that night, because he had two songs that were in the hits in the top 10. One was Donna, which was written for Donna Ludwig, and then the other was La Bamba, which was on the flip side of the 45. So how many times do you hear a single that had two great hits on it at once? It's rare today.
Right.
But Richie was afraid of flying, and what made him afraid was in junior high, he'd gone to his grandfather's funeral, and over his junior high school, two planes collided, and the wreckage fell down and killed Richie's best friend. Richie also knew that he played the guitar at lunch under this certain tree, and if he'd been there that day, he would have been killed. So he had this in his mind that flying was terrifying. But he did the tour, and for some strange reason, he asked Tommy Alsop if he could have his place. And Tommy Alsop said, "No, I'm going to take the plane because my parents have wired some money for me by Western Union, and I really need it, so no, you're not going to take my seat on the plane." So as the big bopper, Buddy, and when Tommy Alsop went to the airport, Buddy turned to Tommy and said, "Tommy, go back to the surf ballroom where we just played and make sure all our equipment is loaded properly." So he goes back, and when he goes back, there's Richie Valens. Uh-huh. And Richie Valens says, "Come on, Tommy, flip for it. Let's just flip for the last seat." And Tommy Alsop brings out a half dollar. He flips it in the air. While it's in the air, Richie calls out, "Heads." And when the coin lands, indeed, it was heads. But it was flipped back at the ballroom, not at the airport. And when he flipped the coin, he turned to the people around him. He said, "You know, this is the first time I ever won." So he took the last seat on the plane. And then when the plane took off, within 9 miles, it crashed headfirst into the ground, and there were no survivors. And there were a number of myths and legends about the plane. For instance, you know, one of the great untrue myths was that the plane was called American Pie.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people believe that had to do with Don McLean's song, "Bye Bye Miss American Pie," but that's not true.
Right.
There was another rumor, probably the strangest one, was brought up that there was a bullet hole in the back of the pilot's seat.
Oh.
Now, this was told by Jerry Dwyer, who owns the plane. And when we did the Coast to Coast show, I tried to get Jerry Dwyer on, but he's supposedly writing a book right now about it, so we'll see what happens. I did talk to his wife, and he was saying that his pilot was incapacitated, was his words. But I doubt that the pilot was shot, because when the bodies were brought into the coroner's office, and this is probably pretty ghoulish, the coroner, medical examiner, actually went through the pockets of the four dead people in the plane and took out enough money to pay his fees. Now, that's disturbing. And he did take the money out. And then when the spring came, they moved the plane, and they found a handgun. And the handgun belonged to Buddy Holly. And what was strange about the gun is that it had been fired twice. So a story evolved about when the plane had taken off, the big bopper was sitting in the back of the Beechcraft Bonanza behind the pilot. Buddy was sitting next to the pilot up front. And there was a story that maybe they had tried to change places because the big bopper was a rather large fella, and it would give him more leg room. And then maybe Buddy Holly's briefcase, where Buddy was always paid in cash. He always carried cash in his briefcase along with a gun to protect himself. And perhaps the briefcase came open, the gun fell, discharged, shot the pilot, the plane crashed, And that was one of the great myths or legends that had to be, you know, sort of dealt with. So when I researched it, I found that the gun had been fired twice by the farmer who had found the gun. So it took all that out. But the story and the myth was so strong that J.P. Richardson Jr., who calls himself the Big Bopper Jr., performs his father's songs. He actually had his father's body autopsied to find out if he had died instantly or what was the reason that the father's body was over 40 feet in front of the plane while Richie and Buddy were found next to the plane. Mm-hmm. And he was afraid that his father may have survived for a while.
Huh. Oh, wow.
So what did he find out?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the man who did the autopsy is Dr. Bass from the Body Farm in Knoxville, which is pretty close to where I live. And so the body was exhumed. And the thing about J.P. Jr., and Jay's an excellent fellow, very nice guy, mm-hmm. he was born 3 months after his father died. So he never saw his father, had never listened, you know, he had to hear all the stories. And his mother had tried to keep him out of the music business.
Oh.
And, you know, she had really laid it down. So he owned a club, and after the club was closed in the evenings, he would play the jukebox, and one of the songs was Chantilly Lace. Uh-huh. And he sang Chantilly Lace, and one of the band promoters said, "Hey, look, you're good. You sound just like your dad. Come on out. We'll put you on the road." So that's how his career started. But he was haunted with the idea of why his father's body was out in front of the plane so far.
Right.
And it may have been that he didn't have a seatbelt. But Dr. Bass did the autopsy. And I guess one of the ghoulish things, I shouldn't say it's ghoulish, I guess it was more inquisitive, mm-hmm. is that Jay stood there, and when they opened the coffin, Dr. Bass told him, he said, "Don't expect anything because it's probably bones and a bunch of cloth. I just don't know if I could see my father's body after 48 years. You know, it would be traumatic to me."
Yeah.
But they opened the coffin, and the Big Bopper was perfectly preserved. They said that his flat top was almost perfectly cut, like that day.
Oh,
so he got to see his father, and they did the x-rays, and the decision was that he died instantly because his skull was, there were numbers of cracks in the skull, his legs were broken. So at least Jay knew that his father didn't suffer, that, you know, it was a very quick death, and probably he didn't have a seatbelt. Mm-hmm. And one of the strange things about the plane that we're still researching is, that when the plane crashed, there was no fire. You'd normally think that after it exploded, you know, there'd be an explosion, it'd be fire after the crash.
Right.
So
right.
There's a, but you know something about the plane? It's still in a hangar. It's in several hangars. Yeah, so a lot of people thought that the plane had been buried because that's what they were told, but the plane's still there. So maybe there may be another forensic study on the plane. But that's some of the great myths and legends of the plane crash. And oh, by the way, Tommy Alsop, he was a Texan, and he went back to Austin, and he started a saloon, and he called it the Heads Up Saloon because that's what saved his life. And another thing about Tommy, the reason he had to get to Western Union was to collect some money from his parents. He gave Buddy his wallet, and when they found that wallet, they were convinced that Tommy Alsop was dead too. And this was the first time before, you know how it is today, you can't contact or make a radio announcement unless you talk to the next of kin and inform them. But everyone found out on the radio, Buddy Holly's parents, Richie Valens' mother, and even the idea was that the Crickets were killed. So all of this was going around when the Crickets weren't there. It was a great, terrible thing with Tommy Alsop. But one thing haunted Waylon Jennings. He went to the airport, and as Buddy Holly was getting on the plane, he turns to Waylon, and he says, "Hey, Waylon, I hope your old school bus freezes up and you freeze." And then Waylon looked at him, and Waylon said, "Yeah, well, I hope your old plane crashes." And he said he never, never got over it. And that was that's what happened on February the 3rd, the night the music died.
This is amazing. No, I agree with George. There's no accidents, Gary. This is too much.
There's a lot more to it because after Buddy Holly died, I mean, I don't know how much you know about your early rock and roll history, but Phil Spector was probably the greatest producer in American music at that time. And in England, the greatest British producer was a character whose name was Joe Meeks. Joe Meeks was into the occult. He loved to play with Ouija boards. Well, one night he decided to do tarot cards, so he had two friends with him, and they shuffled the cards. One turned them over. The other wrote the prediction down, and the prediction was Buddy Holly dies February 3rd. Now, this was in 1958. So he tried to get in touch with Buddy Holly and to tell him, you know, try to warn him about February 3rd. But nothing happened on February 3rd, 1958. The Crickets came to London in March. Joe Meek tells him, he says, whatever you do, be careful on February 3rd. Well, Holly promised he would, but Buddy Holly died on February 3rd, 1959, exactly the date that Joe Meek had received. Well, when this happened, Joe Meek started having seances, and he actually called up the spirit of Buddy Holly, and he played a song for him, and the song was called A Tribute to Buddy. And Buddy Holly supposedly told him, see you in the charts. And the song charted very well in England, but not in the United States.
Wow.
And Joe Meek became so obsessed with the occult that basically he was going to be evicted from his apartment. And this was probably in, I was trying to find the date, I think it was in 1967. But Joe Meek committed suicide on the anniversary of the plane crash on February 3rd, 1967. So here's another date that's tied into it. And it seems like everybody who took Buddy Holly's place in the Crickets for the next few years, they also had a terrible thing happen. You want to go over those? Or
sure.
Would you like
my goodness. I mean, I could just sit here and listen to this. Getting quite a schooling of things like that. Wow.
What happened to the Crickets? Well, the Crickets had gone their own way because Buddy wanted to live in New York. And the Crickets, they wanted to go back to Lubbock, Texas. So Buddy agreed to let the Crickets keep the name, and whoever they played with, it would be the Crickets, and Buddy Holly would just be known simply as Buddy Holly. And there was a rumor that the Crickets were going to get back together with Buddy at the end, and I think there's some truth to that. But the show had to go on, and Buddy was gone. So they brought in a singer from Texas whose name was Ronnie Smith. Ronnie Smith finished out the tour, but Ronnie had a drinking problem. So at that time, there were no rehabs. So he checks himself into a hospital and hangs himself for some reason. Well, the Crickets needed a new singer, so they found this 17-year-old kid whose name was David Box. And Box was a Texan. He was so much like Buddy Holly. A lot of people think his version of Piggy Sue Got Married is actually Buddy Holly. He was that close. And he actually flew out to California and lived with Piggy Sue and Jerry Allison. Jerry was the drummer for the Crickets. And he performed with them for a few years, and then he became a solo artist, just like Buddy Holly. Well, in a case of rock and roll deja vu, he rented a small plane on October 23rd, 1964, and he and two members of his band were killed in a plane crash. And both David Box and Buddy Holly were both 22 years old when they died.
Oh, my God.
And then, are you familiar with the story of Bobby Fuller? Ever heard of him?
No.
You ever heard the song, I Fought the Law and the Law Won?
Oh, yes. Of course.
Yes, well, that's Bobby Fuller. And Bobby Fuller did the song. The song was written by Sonny Curtis, who was one of the Crickets. And it was a monster success for Bobby Fuller. When Bobby Fuller first started out, he sent a demo tape to Buddy Holly's parents. Buddy Holly's parents passed the tape along to Norman Petty, who was the producer of Buddy Holly. So Bobby Fuller went to Clovis, New Mexico, just like Buddy Holly. He recorded for Norman Petty, but then Bobby Fuller moves to California. And while he's in California, he brought his mother over. They were living at his apartment. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, he gets a very strange phone call. He tells his mother, he says, listen, I have to go out, but I'll be back in a few hours. Don't worry about me. And he borrowed his mother's Oldsmobile. So off he goes. Well, no one heard anything from him the whole night. The next morning, no Bobby. Later that evening, sometime around 6 or 7, his mother heard the car pull into the garage. But 30 minutes later, no one had left it. So she goes into the garage, and what she sees across the front seat, she sees Bobby's body. And he had been badly beaten. He was doused with gasoline. His left index forefinger was broken. And he had gasoline in his stomach. So they call the police, and the Hollywood police claimed that it was a suicide. Well, listen, how can you beat yourself so bloody blue and then go out and drink gasoline? Because if you try to ingest gasoline, you automatically throw it up. It's impossible to do it while you're living.
Right.
So the mystery with Bobby Fuller is what happened to him. And that's a story we're still investigating. But what's interesting about Bobby Fuller was the last song he recorded was Love's Made a Fool of You, which was a song by Buddy Holly. And it was the last song. And when Bobby Fuller died, he also was 22 years old, the exact same age as Buddy Holly.
Gee, my goodness.
It gets spooky, doesn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it is. It just seems like that, you know. Wow.
Well, I was
and that's what we're talking about, coincidence. Yeah.
Well, I was just looking at some of the things you mentioned in your email. One of the things that caught me was your first book, The Walrus Was Paul, which examines
right.
a number of clues about that dealt with Paul McCartney's death in 1966. What's this?
Actually, 1969 is when it came out.
Oh.
All right. This is probably, now, I could tell you that I said it's probably the greatest hoax on American radio, but probably, I would say Orson Welles has that with the invasion from Mars,
yeah,
you know.
War of the Worlds.
That story.
Yeah,
yeah
that
War of the Worlds. Everybody was bringing cows because they were afraid they had to have enough milk when they left their homes from the Martian invasion. Nothing like that happened with McCartney. But here's the thing. Let me set it up for you. The Beatles last performed, the last performance was in 1966. Actually, the last tour was in 65 in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who was on that tour with him. His name's Barry Tashin, and he's
mm-hmm.
in a group called Barry and the Remains. So he got to do the tour. Mm-hmm. And the Beatles are getting very tired of touring.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1967, when the Sgt. Pepper's album came out, the Beatles looked different. I mean, they had mustaches. Lennon had his glasses. The music changed. I mean, it changed completely. There's
mm-hmm.
a major change in music from Sgt. Pepper's than, say, Rubber Soul.
Oh, yeah.
And the album Revolver, which is my favorite Beatle album, that
oh,
was
yeah.
the very beginning of the psychedelic period, like Tomorrow Never Knows and all that. So the music was evolving with the Beatles, but when Sgt. Pepper's came out, a lot of Beatle fans said, this is just different, this album and Magical Mystery Tour. So what happened was a rumor passed along that Paul McCartney had been killed in a car accident in England. And after leaving Abbey Road Studios, after arguing
right.
with Ringo and the other Beatles, which obviously they did have some pretty good rows in those days,
mm-hmm.
and he was driving a Lotus Aston Martin convertible, that was his car, the car crashed, he was killed. And then EMI forced the three surviving Beatles to bring in a lookalike, an imposter, so that they could still generate millions of pounds, and the Beatles were forced to go along with it until the contract was over. And then after their contract had expired, the Beatles could go their own way and be solo artists. Now, the only problem to the rumor was that the three Beatles wanted to get messages to their fans that this was not the real Paul McCartney. And the clues are incredible. Now, in The Walrus is Paul, I divide them into three categories. And the first category is simply, you know, totally ridiculous. Because once you find something or an idea, you can go back and just about make anything fit by pushing
mm-hmm.
it in. It's kind of like taking a round ball and smashing it with a sledgehammer to a square cube shape, you know. But you can make it fit, but, you know, it's going to be some area. The second category I always call guided looking and guided listening, because if you hear a backward track or you see something, or say the first time you don't see it, when someone points it out, it's much easier to see it, and then all of a sudden you believe it.
Right.
So that's the second category. But the one that interested me the most is the third, which means the Beatles had actually planted some of the clues themselves. And, you know, when I did the book,
mm-hmm.
I'll have to tell you, the Beatles actually did at least plant two clues that are incredible.
Wow.
And, you know, so if you haven't heard the Paul is Dead story, I mean, it was so big. When Russ Gibb got a call in his station in Michigan in October 1969 from a guy whose name was Tom. And Tom tells him, he says, I want to rap with you about McCartney being dead and what's all this. And
right.
as soon as they started bringing up clues, it swept over the entire United States. And the Beatles didn't say anything. Now, they did get a message about it. One of the figures at Apple Records goes to McCartney and he says, Paul, there's a DJ in the United States saying you're dead. What do I tell him? And McCartney said, well, it sounds like good publicity to me. Tell them I'm not, you know. But no one had seen it. Even Eric Clapton did an interview, and he said, well, I haven't seen Paul in a few months.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, all this created a public hysteria.
Mm.
And if they had known some of the clues that we know now, you know, it would have been so much better in 1969. Because Life magazine actually had a cover story called Paul is Still With Us.
Uh-huh.
It actually made the cover of Life magazine. Now,
wow.
You want to hear the greatest clue of all?
Yes, I'd love to.
All right. So all your listeners, if you've got a Beatle collection, you need to get your Sgt. Pepper album out.
Okay.
Or if you only have the CD, you need to get it out too.
Okay.
And then take a small, straight-edged mirror, and you'll find the clue. And what you do is you look at the cover. And on the Sgt. Pepper cover, you have the Beatle standing behind what appears to be a freshly dug grave, freshly
mm-hmm.
turned dirt.
Yeah.
And the people behind him are supposed to be the mourners in the crowd.
Okay.
Life magazine brought up an article where Paul is standing there and there's an open hand above his head. And
mm-hmm.
for some reason, they say that was a Far Eastern symbol of death. Or it was a symbol of benediction when someone's buried. The least case scenario, why is McCartney the only Beatle with an open hand over his head? He's being picked out of the group. So
right.
maybe it's a coincidence, okay?
Okay?
But if you look in the crowd, you'll see a black and white figure of Lewis Carroll. And
yes.
what was Lewis Carroll's most famous novel, Alice's Adventures Through the Looking Glass?
Mm.
So there's the clue, okay?
Mm.
Now, when I researched the album, I found that there were two drum skins designed. Drum skins look similar,
okay.
except for the Lonely Hearts phrase. I mean, everything's different except for Lonely Hearts. It's the same font. So what you do, you take the straight edge mirror, you place it in the center of Lonely Hearts, and it
mm-hmm.
spells out a cryptic message from the reflection in the glass to the album cover. Going from the left, you will see numeral 1,
mm-hmm.
or a capital I. And then you will see O-N-E, which spells out 1 again. The next two figures over is numeral I and X, which is numeral 9. And then you see he die. And between he and die is a diamond-shaped arrow that points straight up to Paul McCartney and down to the grave.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
And when you see that, at first I was trying to say, what does this mean? 1, 1, 9, he
uh-huh.
die. And I thought, well, maybe what it means is one of the Beatles, the one with 9 letters, he die. Well, McCartney had 9 letters. But see, if this was a grave, that wouldn't be it. So what we have to do is we have to decide that the epitaph is on the bass drum. And one of the clues that gave that to me was that the designer of the drum skin's name was Joe Epgrave. Now you take the name Ep and Grave. Doesn't it sound a little bit like epitaph over
and
grave?
It does.
Uh-huh. So what do you find on a tombstone? You find the name of the person where the arrow points at McCartney, but you also find the date of his death.
Right.
So you take 119, it actually becomes 11/9, November the 9th, okay? In 1966, in at least 3 other Beatle books, they mention a car accident Paul McCartney had on November 9th, 1966.
Mm-hmm.
The accident was on a Wednesday. If you look in the calendar, you'll see November 9th is a Wednesday, and the accident occurred at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, turn the album cover over, and you'll see that the Beatles are standing looking at the camera, pretty somber face. McCartney has his back to the camera,
mm-hmm.
and there's George Harrison standing next to him, and Harrison is pointing with his finger. Now, you got to remember, this picture was made before the lyrics were placed on it because it was the first album in rock and roll history to have the lyrics actually placed on the album. So, if you look to where George is pointing, he's pointing to the first line of She's Leaving Home. Do you know what that line says?
No.
All right, Beatle trivia time. Here it is. Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock as the day begins.
Yes, indeed. I'm sitting here mouthing it. I hate to tell you what a Beatle geek I am.
Are you?
I hate to tell you what a Beatle geek I am. My grandmother gave me the Yellow Submarine for my 7th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
It was my first album. I was kind of an eclectic kind of a chick anyway. I still am. I mean, I got that and Janis Joplin's last album, Pearl.
Oh, Pearl, yeah.
And so I'm sitting here with my mouth hanging open because, you know, as soon as we're done with this, I'm running to get my Sgt. Pepper and do this.
Well, I guarantee you that when you see it, you'll feel that little tingle when you see it because this had to be planted by the Beatles.
Wow.
I mean, there is no way that would be set up that way with the arrow pointing to McCartney, the
right.
open hand over his head, all right? And what really gets me is that in 1967, someone created one of the greatest clues of the greatest hoax ever. Mm-hmm. And for many years, no one knew about it. So, you know, that's a great discovery, and it tells me the Beatles are up to it. But it doesn't give us the answer, because there's so many other clues. And, you know, McCartney sort of a little bit of a revisionist, because if you remember the song I Am the Walrus?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. A rumor came out when everybody was searching for him that the word walrus was Greek for corpse. Well, that's not true. But there's a line in The Glass Onion where John Lennon sings, here's another, or he says, I told you about the walrus and me, man. You know that we're as close as can be, man. Well, here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul.
It's Paul, yeah.
And that's why I called my book, The Walrus Was Paul. And, you know, that was the idea. And the rumor, even Life magazine said, that black walruses were a symbol or harbinger of death, and that Viking hunters returned when they saw one. So when you look at the album cover, you see this one Beatle figure in a black walrus outfit. Well, in 1969, McCartney told Life magazine, he said, listen, it was John dressed in black, not me. Well, in 1980, in an interview he did in Chicago, someone asked him, he said, Paul, were you the walrus? And Paul says, oh, I was always the walrus. He said, I'll pick up this black walrus head and put it on. I didn't think anything of it. Well, you know, what you think is that 1969 he said it was John. In 1980 he said it was him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is.
It really is. Mm-hmm. That's really, I mean, you know, I wanted to ask you, Shamin, do you see the switchboard? I'm having a little bit of tech problem here.
No, actually, I don't see the switchboard. I can't see it from here. So that there are people that are trying to get in.
Okay, because what, in case I am disconnected, because I'm not bringing it up at all,
okay.
Would you stay on the phone until I call back in? So far, as long as we're on the air, it's not a problem. I just won't be able to bring up callers. So you do see callers, right?
Right.
Yeah.
People hanging out, but just that's what it is. Sometimes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They've been having some issues this week. They've been having issues with that.
Oh, okay.
So it's not just you. I've known this for everyone that they've been having a little bit of fun out there. I think it's something in the atmosphere this week. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, Gary, I'm sorry that I'm the only one that can bring up the callers, but that's okay. We'll definitely get some more information out here and have another show with you so they can ask you questions. But one of the things that I was really curious about is John Lennon's relationship with the number 9.
Well, that's probably one of the greatest and strangest stories of all. Because I did a TV show with NBC. I don't know if you saw it. It was actually on the E! Network. It was called Doom to Die 13 Curses. Were you able to see that?
Oh, yes. I did see that.
You
Yes, I did.
Well, then you may remember me being on the show talking about John Lennon, the number 9.
The number 9. I remember thinking about that. I remember as a kid that kind of scared me like the first time I heard
When you heard Revolution number 9? Yeah.
Yes. That kind of
your Revolution number 9 was rather scary with all the backward sounds and everything in it.
Yeah.
But the thing about Lennon, I mean, if you have the book, my latest book is called Take a Walk on the Dark Side, mm-hmm. Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses. And right now, there's a whole chapter on it. So I'll just give the best part with it.
But okay.
I do know that, you know, Lennon was born on October 9th, 1940, in Liverpool. Liverpool has 9 letters. He was born at 6:30 p.m. 6 + 3 = 9.
Yeah.
Brian Epstein discovered the Beatles on November 9th, 1961. And you add 9 years, that would be 1970. That was the year the Beatles broke up. The Beatles performed on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964. Now, John was into this because he also knew the first song he had written in the Beatles was the one after 909. So he was into the 9. This was something that really gave him a look into what he thought his fate would be. Well, he met Yoko Ono on November 9, 1966. And what's really interesting about that is that's also the date of the supposed car crash with Paul McCartney.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh. Now I'm getting it. Number 9.
Number
you know what it is? And he did the song Revolution 9. He also did song Number 9 Dream. Remember that?
Yes.
And when he moved to New York, he moved in 1971 with Yoko. And he actually put, he called himself, had his name changed to John Winston Ono Lennon, so that between he and Yoko, they would have nine O's in their name. So this was done by him. When they get to New York, they move into the Dakota, and their apartment was number 27. 2 + 7 = 9. And by the way, Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, died on August 27th, which 2 + 7 = 9. So all this was not lost on Lennon. The address of the Dakota is 72nd Street. Seven plus two is nine.
Nine plus two is nine. Oh, my God.
Uh-huh.
I have that all the time.
And when
that
John came back.
The Dakota is really, it's actually really like a nice building. Wow.
Very, very interesting building. Matter of fact, John and Yoko actually had a seance in the apartment to not disturb any of the ghosts that were there, asking their permission to move into the Dakota because a lot of the residents didn't want the Lennons there. But it seems like the spirit world agreed to it. But the other thing is that on December 8, 1980, the day that John Lennon was murdered, he came back from the record plant. He walked into the gate. Mark David Chapman shoots him. They rushed him to the hospital, so he was shot on 72nd Street. They rushed him to Roosevelt Hospital. Roosevelt has nine letters. You know what the address of Roosevelt Hospital is? Ninth Avenue. And John Lennon died and was pronounced officially dead at 11:07. 7 + 1 + 1 = 9.
Nine.
Wow.
And he was the only person who was ever murdered who lived in the Dakota. In the Playboy interviews, there was a gunshot fired, and John Lennon said, oh, another murder at the Rue Dakota. Well, the Dakota was built in 1881. So you know what you can do with that. 1 + 8 = 9. 8 + 1 = 9. 9 + 9 = 18. 1 + 8 = 9.
Yep.
So it was 99 years to the day it was built, two nines, and he was the first murder. Now, one of the strangest things is get your magical mystery tour album out, and there's a picture of John Lennon with his thick mustache standing in front of a sign that says, the best way to go is by MDC. And it was supposed to be MD Coach. But think of the initials. The sign says, the best way to go is by MDC, the exact three initials of
Mark David Chapman. Oh,
and here's another thing.
God.
Do you know when the Magical Mystery Tour album was released? It was released on December 8th. All right. 1967, which was 13 years to the day that John Lennon was murdered by Mark David Chapman. And since he died at 11:07 on December 8th, he didn't make it to the 9. However, Lennon was from Liverpool, and he was not an American citizen. So at the very moment he was killed, England is 5 hours ahead. So he did die in England on December the 9th.
Oh, God, that gives me chills. Now, didn't Yoko Ono, or is this a rumor, did she teach acting or dance to Chapman, the person that killed John? Or
she didn't teach acting, but after John died, there was a movie made for television that was called John and Yoko, A Love Story, okay? And she had supervised and was a consultant for the film. Well, the person who got the role of John, the very first actor who got it, well, guess what his name was? He had changed his name. He had a pen name that he used, as actors do. But his real name was Mark Chapman.
Oh.
And when Yoko found that out, she had him replaced.
I bet.
And I think the other actor's name was Mark Lindsay, I believe, not the one from Poverty and the Raiders, but that was a television show, so that may be what you're thinking about.
That could be, yeah.
He did have an actor, yeah, whose name was Mark Chapman that she replaced.
And she just replaced. Yeah, what about Jim Morrison? Is he dead?
Yeah, what a great story. I mean, one night, you know, I mean, I've investigated all this. I've been to Père Lachaise like seven or eight, well, probably about nine times, I guess. And every time I go to Paris, I always drop by and see Jim, you know.
Yeah.
And it used to be very, I guess you'd say romantic, if you got there in New York like 1990, 91, because there was graffiti everywhere at Père Lachaise. And it's a huge cemetery, very beautiful, Gothic. And you've got these sepulchers that reach up to the heavens, it looks like, but you could get lost easily in there.
Right.
And when I walked in the first time, I was just following the graffiti. You'd see a sign that says Jim with an arrow. And then you go a little further, you say Jim, and the eye becomes an arrow going straight ahead. And then when you got closer, there would be Doors lyrics appearing on tombstones. And finally, when you found the place, I guarantee you, even today, if you go to Morrison's grave, there'll be at least 50 people around it. They're taking pictures. And I'm telling you that, you know, Morrison was probably one of the leading, most controversial figures of the counterculture. And, you know, he was one of few people who could start a riot on stage. I mean, he was arrested in Miami for indecent exposure.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this about his father, who just passed away not too long ago, but his father was the youngest admiral ever made into the United States Navy, Steve Morrison. He was a pilot. And when his son was arrested, and his son refused, he told the draft board in California that he was gay, so he wouldn't go in the military. And Morrison's father had actually sent agents to have his son arrested. So there was a major conflict within the family. I mean, they loved each other, but this was not good for your career if you are, you know, an admiral in the Navy.
Yeah, you don't exactly want this coming around.
Right. You don't want that. So his son, when Jim was found guilty, Admiral Morrison went and offered to resign his command. You know, like all good soldiers fall on their sword, but they would not accept his resignation.
Okay.
Now, the interesting part is, why do you think Morrison went to Paris?
That I don't know.
All right. If I gave you the name Roman Polanski and I gave you the name Oscar Wilde, that's two clues, because France has no extradition treaty with the United States for sex crimes.
Okay.
And Morrison's attorney was convinced that if Morrison was put in prison, that he'd be murdered there. So he told Jim to go to Paris, stay there. And Jim was tired of being a rock star. He told the other Doors that he was going to go to France and he was going to go out and reinvent himself. When he heard the album, the last album the Doors did was L.A. Woman. And he told the Doors, he said, "You think this is good? Well, you see my other stuff." Well, he went to Paris. He was recording a number of albums. At the Doors actually got some of his clips, American Dream, and did that. American Prayer, sorry. But he goes in, and he dies. And this is all very mysterious, because I have to tell you, 2 years ago, I was in Paris, and I went to Père Lachaise, and I stood in front of Morrison's grave. I just see how it changes every year. And I miss Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek by one day. Now, Robbie's a good friend of mine, and I don't know if you heard the show I did on Coast to Coast with Robbie and Ray.
No.
It was probably, oh, wow. And we did that one. So I missed him because I thought it'd be kind of cool, you know, talking about Morrison and his grave with Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek from the Doors. I missed it. Go back. As soon as I get home, a book comes out in France saying that Jim Morrison died in a French nightclub. I think it was the Electric Circus. That he was given an overdose of heroin, but they found him in the bathroom, that a paramedic came in, took the vital signs, pronounced him dead, and the two men who had sold him the heroin said, no, he's not dead. And they carried him back to his apartment and put him in the bathtub. Now, here's where it gets interesting. When Morrison's body was found, he was found with his back against the faucets. Now, I don't know how many people actually take baths with their backs against the faucets. Stay away from that. Extremely uncomfortable. So, you know, perhaps somebody had planted him in that bathtub with the water, so it appeared like he died of natural causes.
Yeah.
But if that's true, if he was planted in the bathtub, then his girlfriend, Pamela Corson, all her story will be thrown out, because she's the one who says that he got up, he took the bath, she fixed him a sandwich, and then everything else happened. So that story's not going to hold up if it's true that he died in the bathroom. But what else is strange is that when he died, if it was a drug overdose and the police came, the first person they're going to look for is who sold him the heroin.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Pamela Corson was a junkie.
Yep,
and
she was.
She had. And if she were caught, then she'd be in prison. So she had to get a doctor that she could convince that Jim had died of respiratory failure, heart attack through that. And he had visited a doctor a few days before. So the French doctor signed the death certificate, but the funeral homes were closed in Paris. It was a holiday. So the undertaker came with a body bag and put Jim's body in the body bag, filled it up with dry ice, and Pamela Corson slept next to him for 2 nights.
God.
When the word finally got to the Doors office in Los Angeles that Jim Morrison had died, I mean, every year Jim Morrison had died, they'd all heard this. The manager was sent, Bill Siddons was sent over, and when he was sent to check on the news of Morrison's death, Ray Manzarek held him by the arm, and he said, "And Bill, make sure." Now, what do you think he meant by make sure? It was to make sure that he was dead. Well, when Siddons gets to Paris, he sees this wooden veneer coffin.
Mm-hmm.
The lid had been screwed in place. The coffin was carried to Père Lachaise. I think he was buried somewhere, let's see, I don't know, probably about the 9th, I think, or the 8th of July. He was buried in a very small service. And when Siddons came back, Manzarek said, "Well, how did the body look?" He said, "Well, I never saw the body. All I saw was a sealed coffin." Well, guess what happens now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story is, who saw Jim Morrison's body? Pamela Corson said that he was dressed in a blue suit, you know,
okay,
that she had purchased for him. But Pamela didn't buy a tombstone, you know. They leased the grave.
The grave was leased.
Yeah, it was leased.
No money.
It was leased for something like, 30 years, something like that. But what was the big clue on all this was that in July 2001, the French were going to have him exhumed and sent back to L.A. I guess it was the Jim Morrison L.A. tour. But it was because of all the damage to the cemetery by the graffiti.
Yeah.
But what had happened, the Morrison family agreed to put burglar alarm sensors in the grave, and they paid to have all the graffiti cleared, and the French government allowed Jim to stay. So the definitive answer was going to be, when the body was exhumed, they were going to open the coffin and see if Jim Morrison was there. Now, this sounds a little different, but we got to remember, Jim Morrison had an IQ of over 150.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
He was extremely, extremely intelligent. Mm-hmm. And he had told the Doors that he could see himself dropping out of music altogether, putting on a three-piece suit, and going into something else. So imagine my surprise a couple of years ago when I get a call from the producer of Coast to Coast, who tells me, "Gary, you got to come on the show because this guy claims Jim Morrison is alive and living in Oregon."
What?
Oh, my goodness.
And we need you to talk about this. I mean, you need to find out. So I missed the night the manager was on, but I did come on the show the next night, and I told everything that was known about Morrison's death. And then the next night, I called the guy in Oregon. He was saying, "Yeah, this is Jim. He's a cowboy. He lives up here. He's, you know, but he's wanting to get back in the music business." And I'm sitting here going, something strange about this story. If you want to get back in the music business, why do you get a guy who operates rodeos to bring you back?
And I said,
"Well, look, why don't we do a great show?" I said, "What we'll do is I'll fly up and I'll bring George and Tom Dantheimer, George's producer, and we'll fly up to Oregon, and we'll do a DNA test.
Right.
And we'll see for sure if the Lizard King is back, you know." And they go, "Well, I can guarantee that he can come." But see, the thing was, they never let me speak to Jim Morrison, or the guy who claims to be Morrison. And then it got even stranger. I received an email.
That's impossible.
It's strange enough, isn't it? I got an email from South America from a female writer.
Uh-huh.
She said, "Gary, I've got to warn you. These people are dangerous. There's guns involved. He's been in prison, blah, blah, blah." So, you know, here I'm getting this little warning here, you know?
Yeah.
And but we talked through it. And eventually, the guy who claimed to be the manager, he could not guarantee, even if we were in Oregon, that he'd let us meet with the guy who claimed to be Morrison.
Wow.
So that story to me is effectively, you know, it's just over. I mean, there's too many holes in it. Yeah, too many holes. But, you know, the strange story is how many people claim to be children of Jim Morrison.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Oh, well, let me tell you, I get interesting emails. Can you believe that?
I can imagine you do.
And if they knew my phone number, I would really be lit up on it. But,
oh, you have a hard way to go.
Well, the one thing that's kind of interesting is I have a good friend. His name is Alan Graham, and he was Jim Morrison's brother-in-law. He was married to Anna Morrison. And his son, Dylan, is Jim Morrison's nephew. So, you know, he's in the estate. And when I ask Alan about all this, you know, I normally expect, because Robbie and Ray, they say, no, it's crazy. You know, he's dead. Mm-hmm. He's there. Mm-hmm. But when I ask Alan, he says, well, you know, there's some strange stuff about this. And he said, why do you think they don't want to dig up the grave? And I go, well, because, you know, it's a famous resting place for a famous French poet, you know, mm-hmm. an American poet, Morrison. And he said, no. He says, well, they ended up in the Bodywood there. Now, this is what his brother-in-law told me.
Oh, my God.
So, obviously, the legend is still going to be going,
even though
most people deny it. But I've had phone calls. This one guy called me. He's from New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And he says, look, he said, I got to tell you this. He said, when I was growing up, my mother and father really didn't have a lot of money. They worked in convenience stores. And nothing wrong with that. But he said, we lived in this beautiful home.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we had Corvettes and Porsches all over the place. And he said, I had a private trust fund.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the money was put in there, and, you know, we couldn't say anything about who put the money in. But they sent me to the finest schools. I graduated, and he had his own business. And he says, one night I was singing in a band who did Doors imitations. I was in Memphis, Tennessee, and as I sang, two people came up to me. And those persons' names would be Andy Morrison and Anna Morrison, Jim Morrison's brother and sister. And they looked at me, and they said, could you be our nephew?
Oh.
And he said, you know, he said, I don't know. He said, because my mother, and he gave me her name,
uh-huh.
was involved with Jim Morrison before
what?
He died. And he says, I think that maybe this money that was deposited for me came from a legal agreement with the Doors managers. And he says, now let me tell you this. He says, I do not want a penny. I don't need any money. I don't need anything. But he said, there's something that haunts me about it, and I'd like to find out if I am. And if I am, I don't want anything. He said, one day, when it got on the Internet, he said I found this guy snooping around my house. And when I went outside to confront him, the guy says, oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure if I was living next to the lizard prince. I mean, can you imagine that?
No.
And, wouldn't that be a great reality television show?
Oh, that would be a fantastic show right there, because there's so much that's tied in there. I was going to ask you about that, because I know a few years back with Kurt Cobain and that age of 27, because how old was Morrison when he died?
Oh, Morrison was 27, right?
27 years old.
And wasn't like Janis Joplin 27, Jimi Hendrix
Janis
27.
Joplin was 27, Jimi Hendrix was 27. I mean, when I wrote Hellhounds on Their Trail, I was going to write up some of the great mysteries of some of the rock stars' deaths. So the first thing you do is you look up Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones. Did he actually drown or was he murdered?
Right.
Because now there's a deathbed confession by Frank Thurgood saying that he drowned Brian.
For what?
And so I'm saying, wow, you know, here is a murder mystery. But then, you know, it's always up in London, you know, well, both men are dead. Why should we investigate? But it all goes back, in my book, to the beginning of rock and roll. And it goes back with a blues man whose name was Robert Johnson.
Oh,
have you ever heard the story of Robert Johnson?
Yes, indeed.
Not me.
Well, let me tell you the Robert Johnson story.
All right.
Robert Johnson was born in Mississippi, right around Clarksdale. And there is a legend. Well, actually, the story goes that Johnson wasn't a very good musician. He actually played the harmonica, and he played some other things. But the old blues guys like Son House and Charlie Patton, they used to dodge him because he always wanted to sit in and play his guitar, and he was terrible. Well, he disappears for a few weeks, maybe a few months, looking for his father, supposedly going to Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he was the most incredible guitarist on the Mississippi Delta. And when he started to play, Son House turns to the others and said, you know, he sold his soul to play like that.
To play like that, yes, indeed.
And there is the story of a special crossroads right outside Clarksdale, Highway 61 meets Highway 49. And at midnight, the story goes that a blues guy could take his guitar and he could sit at that crossroads, and he'd play a few licks. And when he played those blues licks, if he played them good enough, he would feel a presence behind him. And this presence, this huge black man who would appear behind him, would reach over his shoulder. If the blues man offered up his guitar, the stranger would take it, and you could hear the strings being retuned into a special tuning. When the guitar was handed back and you accepted it, you had made your deal. You had signed the pact.
Oh my God.
And the story goes that when Robert Johnson played, people filled in everywhere to hear him because of his legend. And when he would play, when the light, he had a cataract in one of his eyes. And when he would look up, the light would hit that cataract and his eye would glow. And they were convinced that was the evil eye or he was possessed.
At certain
patterns he played, he would turn his back to the audience. And when he turned his back to the audience, they were thinking, ah, that's that special tuning. He's got something to hide. Well, one night, he drank from a bottle of open whiskey that was laced with strychnine. It took him 3 days to die, and according to the story, he died on his hands and knees howling like a dog.
Oh my God.
And Robert Johnson died at the age of 27.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes him interesting is that Robert Johnson, according to Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Keith Richards, a lot of the great British blues men, they say that Robert Johnson was the founder of rock and roll for his unique playing style. So if rock and roll was founded at that mysterious crossroads, what other forces could have been unleashed, as the story goes? This is a great novel. Should be a film.
Oh,
course,
yeah.
Should
be a film. You have
and
a lot of people going in there.
Strychnine. Well, who killed him? Who put the strychnine in the whiskey?
Wasn't he supposed to have something to do with women?
It did. See, Robert Johnson, when he played in a juke joint, he would pick out a certain woman who would be his companion as long as he played there. Well, when he played his last juke joint, he picked out a woman who had a husband who had a very violent temper, and he was the one who put the poison in the whiskey. So when Robert Johnson died at 27, I'd written that story, and then I went to Brian Jones, and I said, oh, my gosh, you know, isn't that odd? Brian Jones was 27 years old when he died. And then I went further. Jimi Hendrix died at 27, and Janis Joplin. When Jimi Hendrix died, Janis Joplin said, Jimi Hendrix died today. She said, I'm sure glad I didn't die today because he'd get all the ink. He'd get all the press. She died 2 weeks later.
Oh,
and guess what?
No.
Hendrix was 27. Janis Joplin was 27. Okay? And then Jim Morrison died. He was 27. And when Morrison was in Miami, and when he had heard, he was reading about Hendrix and Joplin's death, he turned to his friends and he said, you know, you're drinking with number three, is what he said. And he was dead, too. And a matter of fact, Jim Morrison died on July 3rd, which was the exact day that Brian Jones had died the year before, or 2 years before. So now he's dead. Well, there's others. For instance, Pigpen from The Grateful Dead, the keyboardist, he died at 27. Blind Al Wilson from Canned Heat died at 27. Pete Hamm, lead singer for Badfinger, died at 27. Chris Bell from Big Star died at 27. Kristen Pfaff from Hole died at 27. Kurt Cobain died at 27. Jason Furst from Pennywise died at 27. And what was really interesting is I did the major stars who died at 27, and there's two things that are kind of funny. One thing is John Mayer did an interview with BMI, and I heard the interview. And John Mayer said, well, he said, I think my greatest accomplishment, I made it past 27. That's what he said.
I know he felt that way, too.
Right. And Gretchen Wilson, the country singer, they asked her how old she was. She said, let me tell you, I don't mind telling you my age because I made it past 27. So now, I guess after I found this, it sort of sinks in to a lot of rock stars who are 27. But after I did Coast to Coast, I got an email from Ian Punnett. And this student in college, he's working on his PhD, was doing a statistics course, and he said, let me tell you what I did for fun. He said, I went and I found every rock star, date of their death, how old they were, and I put it in a computer, and I averaged it up to find out at what age most of them died. And he said there were 42 rock stars who died at the age of 27.
Oh, give me a break.
That's what I was saying. I think that was.
And he said it was the number one age of their death. Now, some people say, yeah, but, you know, it's their image. They use drugs. Well, that might be true. But why didn't they die at 19? Or why didn't they die at 32?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter their lifestyle. So is it a... Is it numerology? Is 2 + 7 9, and that's the highest number? Spiritual power? Who knows?
Yeah, we need to talk to a numerologist. Who's that one on Coast to Coast all the time? She's in.
Yeah, I have my good friend Lloyd Strayhorn. He would have a great time with this.
He'd
have a numerologist.
Well, was Janice stopping me? Is there any kind of rumor, Gary, that she was murdered?
You know, you ask the greatest questions. Let me tell you, I mean, this is really good. I just done a show on Janis Joplin with George, and I got a great email. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought I'd lost you. And I got an email from this woman in Los Angeles, and this is what the email said. She said, I've never been able to tell this before, but are you willing to hear what really happened to Janis? Because the man who was in charge of this, he's now dead. Do you want to hear the real story? So, of course, I say, yeah, tell me the real story. You know, I never heard back from her. But what's really, I never heard back. So if she's listening, you know, call me or give me another email and let's find out what happened. I love Janis Joplin. But her death is so strange because, you know, she was a very depressed person. I mean, think of a girl growing up in Texas whose nickname, cruelly, in her high school was Pig Face. That's what they called her. When she went to college, they entered her for the Ugly Man on Campus Award, and that was always a bad thing. So her heart was ripped out. One thing about Janis Joplin, when she sang, you could feel the emotion and the pain within her. I mean, it's hard to explain that to someone, but you could feel it. Well, it would appear that, you know, if she was going to overdose and kill herself, that she would do it at her deepest point of misery. What's odd was that her will was finalized the day she died. And when she left money for everyone to attend a big party, and on her invitation to her wake, she wrote, "Have one on Pearl," which was her nickname. But she was ready to be married. I mean, there was a guy she was going to marry. She was pretty happy. She goes back to the Landmark Hotel where she died, and she had purchased some heroin, and she overdosed. Now, the problem was that the heroin she used was completely pure. And not only did Janis Joplin die, but there's probably 10 to 12 other people who died that week from the same heroin batch. So it seems like it was just a terrible coincidence with
it. Coincidence.
But, you know, it's always a great story. If this person knows the story, I'm always willing to listen.
And the fact that her will was finalized the day she died, that's a little...
That's something that maybe some people might think suicide. But, you know, another thing about Janis was that she was a big fan of Bessie Smith, the blues singer. And when Bessie died, she was buried in Philadelphia, and she didn't have a tombstone. So 2 weeks before she died, Janis Joplin and a lady who had served as Bessie Smith's maid earlier had purchased a tombstone. They put it in place, and it said, "The Empress of the Blues will never stop singing." And she purchased that tombstone 2 weeks before she died. And the last song her band was working on was Buried Alive in the Blues, and she had not put the vocals on. And that's strange. But, you know, I like these creepy stories. I guess I grew up at a time of the greatest period music in world history, but also grew up living in a Twilight Zone. So the Landmark Hotel where Janis Joplin died was just a few blocks away from the place where Bobby Fuller died. So they're like a block apart, you know, which is really odd, you know. It's just a bad area of Hollywood, I guess.
Bad area of Hollywood. And there is one thing, you know, I don't want to, do you need to take a break? I can play a song, or I just wanted to ask you a couple of more questions.
Oh, I'm having a great time. I mean, let me see. Can you, you remember the song you opened up with, Blue Suede Shoes?
Yeah, and I've got, go ahead.
And you asked me if I knew Carl Perkins?
Yeah.
You want to hear a spooky story about Carl Perkins?
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Of course you do. Right. Well, I was talking to Carl in Nashville, and he was at a Beatle convention, and you know, we got to know each other real well.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me that he had written a song called My Old Friend, and that Paul McCartney had helped him write it. And he said, when I was doing the Tug of War album with Paul, he flew me to the studio. And he said, while we were cutting this song, he said, I just got inspired. And I wrote this song called My Old Friend, Think About Me Every Now and Then. That was the chorus. So I said, Paul, listen to this song I'm writing. And he said, when I sang the chorus, Paul's face just looked pale.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say a word. He said, Carl, wait. He said, I have to go get Linda. So he goes and gets Linda McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, all right, play it for both of us. So they sit down and listen. And every time Carl sang the chorus, My Old Friend, Think About Me Every Now and Then, McCartney would look at Linda. She'd look back. And on the third time he did it, McCartney was in tears. And he walks out of the studio next to the pool. And then Carl turns to Linda and he says, I am so sorry. I don't know what I've done to hurt his feelings. But
mm-hmm.
he said, you know, this song just came to me. And Linda looked at him and she said, Carl, how did you know? And he says, what do you mean, how did I know?
Mm-hmm.
She said, how did you know, Carl? She said, the last time we were with John Lennon in New York, when John was going into the Dakota, he turned to Paul and said, hey, old friend, think about me every now and then.
Oh, no. Oh, God. And he didn't do it on purpose.
Dear, that must
no coincidences, huh?
Yeah, there aren't. That's for sure. I mean, honestly, wow.
You know, I heard you talking, George Norrie, about these backward tracks on records. Now, that's fascinating.
Oh God, when I was a kid, I heard all of that stuff.
Oh, you did
with the Beatles, and it scared the devil out of me. And I just refused to, like, I want to play it backwards. I was like, listen, I like the Beatles. I want you to mess this up for me.
Yeah.
It made me nervous.
Well, I tell you, you know, the first thing you got to remember is that, yes, without a doubt, there are backward tracks on records. And they've been used for the first backward track ever recorded was by the Beatles, and it was on the song Rain. And if you remember the last verse, it sounds like John Lennon is chanting something.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's the reversal of the track. And if you play it backwards, what you hear is simply John Lennon singing, when the rain comes, they run and hide their heads, which is exactly how it sounds forward.
Mm-hmm.
So when this came out, the Beatles liked the way things sounded backwards, like backward cymbals, backward guitar tracks, and Tomorrow Never Knows is a masterpiece of backward tracks off Revolver. So they decided, well, let's have some fun with this. So when the Paul is Dead Rumors came out,
mm-hmm.
if you listen to the song I'm So Tired, right before it, Blackbird ends, and there's a muttering in the track that sounds something like, bleep, 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 bleep,
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, I wonder what that's saying. And what you do when you reverse it, and the first thing I did, I looked up in the Abbey Road recording sessions where they wrote down everything, and they said that Lennon was saying, Monsieur, Monsieur, how about another one? Well, let me tell you, that's ridiculous. He doesn't say that at all. But when you play it backwards, what you hear is, Paul is dead now. Miss him, miss him, miss him. And that will raise a hair up on the back of your neck.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, while we're talking about the Beatles, we're talking before I forget, do you know what John Lennon says at the very first of Come Together?
Uh-uh.
When the song starts, you hear him go, shoot, like that.
Yeah.
What he's saying is, shoot me.
Shoot me.
Oh, my God.
Shoot me. That's what he's saying.
Yeah, because that whole thing ain't going to get me geeked out here. I'm going to be all geeked up when I get done with this.
Me too. The curse of the guy, you know, that's waiting at the crossroads, and he's going to give you make that pack. Now, that I cannot get off my mind. Because how could that guy have been that bad of a player, this Robert Johnson, and then just come into this genius, is what you're saying.
Well,
yeah,
it's true.
That's what
and
they
see,
did.
He used to play guitar. He claimed to play guitar in graveyards at night and claimed that the devil taught him. So I got to tell you this, and I'll go back on the backward tracks. I went to a party in Memphis, Tennessee with four of my old fraternity brothers
mm-hmm.
and their wives and girlfriends. So after we head to party the next morning, Alan says, "Hey, I'm going to take you guys to a very special place." Well, guess where we went? We went to Clarksville, Mississippi, and they had me tell the story of the crossroads, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I take them to where the crossroads is, not the one that they advertise. It's outside town. So that's a little thing, a little secret there. But anyway, the old blues players know it. But there's an old cemetery that started in 1850. So we went up to the cemetery, and we had our picture made with the crossroads in the back, and it was this huge black snake coiled around one of the headstones.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the South, if it's in March, it's a little too early for snakes. But this is the Delta.
Yeah.
And so one of the guy's wives, took a stick and she started hitting that snake, you know,
mm-hmm.
chasing that snake. I said, and I was kind of kidding with her. I said, you know, I think with the legend of all this here, I don't think I'd hit that snake.
Mm-mm.
And she laughed. So we got back in the car. And as we were getting in the car, my friend Alan says, well, let's take a souvenir. So he reaches in the back of his van, pulls out a couple plastic bags, and digs up some dirt
mm-hmm.
from the crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
He gives me a bag. He takes it back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we go to Tunica, went to the gambling casinos, won money. So it was pretty lucky. Come back to his house. And on Sunday, we get ready to leave, come home.
Mm-hmm.
So I come home, and the person I was with, she had my bag of dirt.
Uh-huh.
I forgot it. It didn't get with my stuff. So she calls me frantically the next day. She says, have you heard what happened? I said, no. She said, Carlos, the girl who had the stick hitting the black snake, as soon as she got back into Arkansas, she was rushed into the hospital with a brain aneurysm.
Oh, God.
The Alan, listen, I don't want to scare you, but Alan, the guy who dug the dirt and put it in the plastic bags, he was rushed to the hospital 30 minutes after we left and with a heart attack.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, my goodness.
When she got home, her name was, when she gets home, she finds that her burglar alarm's going off. Nobody's there. She goes to work. The alarm goes off again. She comes back. There's nobody there. She's terrified. And she said, what do I do? I said, listen, take that dirt. Throw it in a river.
Oh, yeah.
Throw it in a river. So they threw the dirt in a river. Everything was fine, you know. I don't know how she wound up with my dirt because, you know, anyway.
Well, that's a
good. So I had no crossroads dirt. It was over. And then Connie, who's with me now, she had a party for me.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan comes up. He all completely healed. He comes up,
mm-hmm.
and he says, oh, I got you a present. So I open up the present, and I see this old antique bottle with a cork in it. And in that bottle is what?
Mm-mm.
Dirt from the crossroads.
Mm-mm.
And I have it sitting above my computer. So if I have to write sometimes, it's maybe a little inspiration. But I'll tell you, I knock on wood, nothing happened to me. And, you know, but is that a coincidence?
Yeah. Why? Why not?
Within 24 hours?
Oh, my God.
That's just...
That's pretty much, you know, that's like right there. It's like the spirit world telling us.
Telling you something. That's
if you want to be a good musician, go to the crossroads, but you're not going to hang around.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you wouldn't have to pay. Well, first of all, I would have disappeared upon the snake. Okay.
Yeah.
The snake would have just
Well,
sent
it was
me
spooky
away.
Enough. But I will tell you this. I know that. You ever watched the TV series Supernatural?
Yes, actually.
Yeah, I
okay.
think I have.
Have you noticed how much this crossroad thing plays in this movie? That they go to the crossroads and summon these demons?
Yeah.
You know, so that legend is still there. So I think that the crossroad things, you would be amazed at emails I receive from musicians who tell me they've been to that crossroad.
Oh, they
you
go
know?
There.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure it doesn't help their playing any, but, you know, just the idea of the old myth.
The
but
myth?
That's what makes Robert Johnson so fascinating, you know?
Oh, yeah,
and,
very.
And, I'm sure it turned on Eric Clapton enough to learn to play his songs, because if you remember a couple of years ago, he had an album called Me and Mr. Johnson, where he cuts all those Robert Johnson songs.
Yeah, they have all of that in there like that. I remember that because I know he's got a particular affinity for the blues.
Yeah,
in particular.
I mean,
honestly, Robert Johnson, I remember I had watched... I'm going to just show what a geek I am. I'm such a geek. It's terrible. But it's like I love music history, and I watched I think it was a City Confidential on A&E,
And it was all about Robert Johnson, that whole legend with him with women, how he got in trouble with women, and
mm-hmm.
how he kept, and it was really kind of watching it. And Paul Winfield, he was narrating. He's since passed away, but he, you know, honestly, since that point, he's the only one who could narrate. It scared the hell out of me, actually. So I really find this so fascinating, though. You can make
well,
a deal with the devil.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you. Are you sure? Was it VH1 Confidential?
Could have been that. Because I know that they've done a couple. Every time it comes on, or I see something
mm-hmm.
like that, I tend to watch those kinds of things.
Oh, I did. See, I was the consultant for that series. And
oh, you were.
When we did Robert Johnson, I'm the guy telling the story.
Yeah,
I've done that one too.
Here,
yeah.
Listening to your voice, saying to myself, "Where have I heard you before?"
That was him.
Oh my God! That
I didn't. I was going to email you his notes, but I didn't get a chance to me. Yeah, I was going
to
say that's him.
I watched both of those things, and they scared the devil out of me. And I was just sitting around there, you know, because you think about that. You think about that area, and that whole area, and it's kind of a little bit, you know, you have those voodoo patches through
mm-hmm.
there and all of that kind of stuff, and it just gives you the real creeps. So I'm like, okay. But I love that kind of stuff like that. Are you going to be doing any, I know, as much as it scares me, see what terrible that is? Are you going to be doing anything else? Are you going to do any specials about like John Lennon? I mean, I think that would be a fantastic one to do.
Well, you're working with Standing in the Shadows of Motown, a documentary?
Well, yeah, actually, I'm doing a movie with Paul Jessman, who's the director of Standing in the Shadows of Motown. And it was an award-winning film on the Funk Brothers from Motown. So we're doing a documentary on the Muscle Shoals musicians. And, they did Percy Sledge, When a Man Loves a Woman.
Yeah.
And what interested us about that story was the idea that, you know, in Muscle Shoals, it's with three small little towns.
Mm-hmm.
And in the center of that is the headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. And yet, here are these white kids
mm-hmm.
who defied that whole social period to play with black artists.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, and I thought, man, what a great story. And one of those artists, Spooner Oldham, who's an excellent, excellent guy, he's a lot of fun, he's being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was reading his introduction, they said, Spooner Oldham, keyboard player for Neil Young and other artists. And I kept saying, no, you need to say Spooner Oldham, who played the organ on Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman and played the entire Aretha Franklin sessions in New York, like Ain't Never Loved a Man and all those songs. That's Spooner Oldham. You know, this guy is incredible. But we were fascinated with that story. So Paul, and by the way, Paul's brother is Seth Jessman, who's the keyboard player for the Jay Giles Band.
So if
Paul can hear me, if he's listening, he's in Boston tonight. But, we're working on that. We've got several films, but I don't want to jinx anything, but I will say that I've been in contact with a large cable network
mm-hmm.
who's talking to me about putting on a series,
which will be
all these stories. So,
I would love to see something like
that.
To be perfectly honest, you see, I really have to tell you, part of the things, I have twin sons that'll be 22 in May,
uh-huh.
and they're both musicians. And sometimes they listen to music, especially today's music. I don't really want to knock at today's music because I suppose it has it. I suppose this is the way people felt about rock and roll. But I tell them, I say, you know, your music today doesn't have the same kind of character that the 50s, I said the story is the 60s, the 50s, the 60s, the 20s, the 30s, the blues.
Mm-hmm.
You guys don't have that. I mean, you've got Britney Spears shaving her head, for God's sakes. Come on.
Yeah. And all the rapping.
But that's just how it is. It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
But these are the stories that you go into, you know. To talk about the history there and some of the dark history, it just gives it such a richness, such fabric to it. And I tell my children all the time, because I've played a lot of this kind of music with my kids growing up. I wanted them to be as exposed to everything as I was, because I listen to almost everything that there is out there. I listen to classical music. I've listened to Robert Johnson. I listen to blues. I listen to rock and roll. I am the ultimate Beatles fan. I mean, it did make me a highly popular girl in my neighborhood, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, you know, we're about to run out of time, Gary. Unfortunately, I could keep you for 2 or 3 weeks. I find this crap. Couldn't you, Shamin? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
He's absolutely wonderful. And I would love, you know, for you to take the last couple of minutes and tell anything about yourself that you want out there, or you want to find out about certain things and get people to contact you, or
yeah, how
do
they email you?
How can they email
you, or is there a website for you?
Let me just say that you can contact me through my website, which is www.rgarypatterson.com. And I always answer my email, so please write me. And if you've got some great stories, I want to hear them. And maybe I ought to leave with a really good story that's not really, I guess, spooky or anything along those lines.
Okay.
But just it's a great story about the Brill Building. You ever heard of his songwriter's name was Doc Pomus.
Okay.
And
okay.
He wrote the song called Say the Last Dance for Me. And at his wedding, he had polio, he had heavy braces, and he had this beautiful wife who was blonde, and she was dancing with all these guys at her wedding. And this is a guy who could never dance, so he takes out a napkin, and he writes the lyrics to Say the Last Dance for Me. And remember the line, don't forget who's taking you home and who's in your arms are going to be? So, darling, say the last dance for me. Written by a man who would never dance. And, I mean, there's so many great stories in pop culture. It's not always dark, but it does give it a richness because it's like literature. You got to remember, I'm also a lit teacher, and I teach a course on the history of rock and roll, and I have kids who love Jerry Cobb and Carole King, and they love hearing the stories. But, I mean, this is a whole period of pop culture that helped change the world. I tell them it's when teenagers change the world, you know, to get involved. So it's fun, and I enjoy it, and I've had a great time with you guys.
Well, thank you so much, Gary. And again, I'm going to give that website. It's www.r, as in Ralph, Gary, G-A-R-Y, Patterson.com. And you can contact Gary through that, and you can find the books that he's written. You can actually see them on our description page. They are scrolling back and forth, three of them, because that's all I could bring up. And you can find those at Amazon.com. And where else can people get your books?
Well, find bookstores everywhere, and if you can't find it at your local bookstore, then obviously it is not a fine bookstore. So.
I love it, Gary.
I like the way you look at it.
And I'll be looking forward to hearing you on a Coast to Coast really soon.
Oh, we've got some great new stories coming up. It's going to be fun. I need to do this again with you guys sometime.
I love it, and you're invited anytime. And thank you, Shamin. We should all get together again.
Yes, I was happy to do that. I'm over here on the East Coast, so it's later in the day for me. So, yes,
well,
definitely.
Thank you. And thank you, Gary. And we will end this with, Jailhouse Rock.
Why not?
Why not? Let's hit it, guys.
All
thank
right.
you. Bye-bye.
Carry us out, Elvis.
Everybody in the old cell phone. looking at a chance to make a break. About to turn the ship to any sense.